all of us who are teaching in English department, even, you know, those among us who have devoted their lives to the hermeneutics of suspicion, or what, you know, Rick Kerr calls the schools of suspicion, even those who think that they're conceive of their job as to sort of, you know, tear off the facade of any apparent goodness, they're still teaching works of literature for the wisdom that they offer. My question, theology still, are we still doing theology? Yes, we are. For me, what I'm trying to say is, yeah, we are. But that's fine.
Charles LaPorte is professor of English at the University of Washington and the author of two excellent books on the intersection of literature and religion, Victorian Poets and the Changing Bible, published in 2011, and, just this year, The Victorian Cult of Shakespeare, Bardology in the 19th Century. We discuss ways that 19th century readers engaged Shakespeare as they would sacred texts, and how that approach continues to describe literary studies even in our secular age.
Charles LaPorte, it is very good to see you this morning here over Zoom. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
It's been, what, about a month since you were out here at BYU? We'll talk about the symposium that you were out here for toward the end of our conversation. But I've got to say, it was great fun to have you out here in person. And this is not as much fun as that, because you're very good company. But still, thank you for taking the time.
No, it was glorious to be out there. It was my first conference in the post-COVID, well, in the COVID era.
Yeah, we say euphemistically post-COVID, right?
Yeah. Formerly post-COVID era.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's given all new meaning to the word Delta. I thought it was an airline. Who knew, right? I usually begin these podcasts, Charles, by asking our guests whether and how their faith informs their work. I know that you were raised Catholic, so let me put a version of my question to you this way. You've written this provocative book about how 19th century devotional practices and biblical interpretive strategies created what you call a cult of Shakespeare, an almost devotional canonization of Shakespeare. And you light on a series of really powerful exchanges between religious and literary, you know, sacred and secular practices and energies. And my question is, could you have written a book like this if you didn't have a religious background yourself? In other words, could you understand what you were looking at in 19th century receptions of Shakespeare without cultivated religious sensibilities of your own?
Yeah, it's a fabulous question. It's an intriguing question. And I think I would probably want to break it up into like the two sort of related questions. You ask, could I have? And the question, would I have, is also present
okay.
to mind. I mean, and partly because I think the question of could I have written a book about 19th century religious culture and Shakespeare's place within it? I think the answer to that question is yes, I think I could have, were I not a religious person, were I not raised in a religious tradition. And I think I could have because what I'm doing is literary history. I'm not a theologian, right? I mean, you've had a ton of people on this podcast who are like legit theologians. Honestly, it made me anxious listening to this podcast before coming on it because I'm like, I'm in over my head. Like, I'm not.
Well, how do you think I feel talking to them, right?
Well, that actually makes me feel better. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm not doing theology, right? You had someone on the podcast, and I'm sort of blanking on who it was, who's talking about editing a journal in religion and literature. And you had asked, you remember who this, I don't remember. You had asked.
Could have been Ramona Huck.
Could have been Ramona Huck. And you were asking about the contributions, whether they were sort of theologically oriented or historically oriented.
Oh yeah, Mark Eaton probably, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was Mark Eaton. So, yeah. and Eaton's like, you know, you get sort of some of both, right? You get the people who are like, here's an important context that you should know about. You know, they're not making any religious claims at all. And then you get, you know, scholarship that's actually making claims in some wise about the nature of the divine. And I guess I'm not making claims about the nature. I'm not qualified to make claims about the nature of the divine. But what I am saying is, like, unless you understand how thoroughly bibliocentric Victorian culture was, you can't pay any attention to what's going on in the this sort of this body of Shakespeare scholarship. And I guess the would I have written such a book question is more interesting to me. Because in so many ways, I think the answer is not. I would not have, were I not deeply versed in a religious tradition. But I'm mindful too that, I mean, one of the interesting things about the archive that I uncover in this particular book is the ways that it, so many aspects of it are like fundamentally, I mean, the devotional way of reading Shakespeare in the 19th century is in many cases pretty wacky, right? And in some cases, like way, you know, really crazy. Like when Charles Downing at the end of the 19th century is making the case that Shakespeare's psalms are or Shakespeare's sonnets are the psalms of a new religion. Like right. That's pretty far out, right? Yeah. And I think my own religious upbringing, by which I mean not sort of Roman Catholicism, but by which I mean like the family in which I was raised, put me in a really good position to appreciate what was going on, because my parents and sort of my family more generally were really seriously religious, but also kind of delightfully playful about. I mean, I was raised with a combination of reverence and irreverence.
Yeah, nice.
That might be a little bit unusual. Can I give you one example?
Please, yeah.
So do you know about the Catholic practice of the Adoration of the Blessed Sacrament? Is this something, would this be on your podcast listeners?
Some will know of it, many won't, so you should explain it.
So like in the Catholic Mass, one of the distinguishing features of Catholicism is the idea that the sacrifice of the Mass, that when the body and blood of Christ are honored in Roman Catholicism, the religion holds that the host and wine actually become the body and blood of Christ in some mystical sense, right? That it's not just a symbol, like it's actually the thing, right? And this goes way back into the Middle Ages, or possibly beyond. But at least the Middle Ages. And so there's a tradition in Catholicism of like devotion to the Blessed Sacrament. So you have like monstrances and stuff, like so that you can show off, here's the consecrated host or what all. Like that's a long tradition. And my own father here in Seattle is someone who participated regularly in the Adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. Like, so he would get up at 5 a.m. every Saturday to go down to have his turn, because the church in which I was raised had 24-hour Adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. There's always someone present with the consecrated Eucharist in the church. And so he's like, this is not something you do if you're not a devout person, right? You just don't get up at 5 a.m. right, and trundle down to sit with the tabernacle, right? So no question about his devoutness. But it's also true that every time my father talked about this practice, he would talk about it as his time babysitting God, right? Yeah. I mean, like where it's, you go down to, you know, sit with the tabernacle. So this was his, like where he would be like, yeah, I got to get to bed early because I'm babysitting God in the morning. Right. I mean, that was his sort of his way of talking about it. It's not that he wasn't, he recognized that God did not need a babysitter. Right. Yeah. I mean, but it was just sort of his way again, he's totally committed to the practice, but he's also, he recognized that there is something even comical about, like he could always find the funny thing in whatever he was doing It didn't mean that he wasn't devoted to it. He went to daily mass, you know?
Yeah, sure. Well, you have that sensibility, Charles. I really like that. That kind of sensibility is all through your book. Because on the one hand, it's very attuned and very alert to devotional practices. Okay. Your book is it's very historically sophisticated and very religiously sophisticated in how it picks out what's happening in the 19th century. But it's also a very playful book. I mean, you have a really good eye for the wacky and the wild in the ways that readers really brought Shakespeare into a kind of an imaginatively religious framework of understanding. And I think that's great. And then you make some really provocative connections to the present and how we have, in some ways, unbeknownst to ourselves, assimilated a lot of those same sensibilities into our modern ways of reading and talking about literature. Well, maybe we can proceed this way. There's a historical side of your book about the 19th century and a more conceptual side about the present day. We can start with the historical side and let our listeners understand a bit more about the nature of your argument. So let's begin here. The Victorian era, the 19th century, it's famous for its negotiation of faith and doubt, right? It's a very religious period, but it also witnesses a series of crises, right, that are brought on by modern science. You know, Darwin's theory of evolution, geological inquiries in the age of a suddenly very ancient seeming earth, and then one to which you devote a lot of attention yourself in your book, which is the German higher criticism. Can you explain what the higher criticism was and the ways that it unsettled traditional Christian faith?
Yeah. So the higher criticism of the Bible, the so-called higher criticism, is the historical criticism of the Bible, the study of its origins, the sort of analysis of the apparent ways in which it came into being historically, as opposed to traditional understandings. Like, the traditional understanding is very straightforward. Like, God says to Moses, look, I want you to write this down, and dictates the Pentateuch, right? Or, you know, the angel comes and whispers into the ear of St. Matthew, and then St. Matthew, like, and you can find lots of religious iconography across the ages sort of demonstrating these things again, the origins is complicated, but by the 18th century, coming out of Germany, there's a strong scholarly consensus, for various reasons that there's no reason to get into here, that this is an unsatisfying view about the origins of the Bible. And part of what they're responding to in the 18th century is looking at sort of the ways that different passages of the Bible fit or do not fit together. You know, one of the super obvious examples is the two creation stories in Genesis, right? That you have, yeah, you know, that sublime opening in Genesis 1, you know, going through Genesis 2, verse 3, that Longinus is like, you know, clearly, you know, the lawgiver of the Hebrews is killing it with the sublime, right? I mean, sort of independently where you know, but then in chapter 2, verse 4, and all the way through then you get a totally different creation account, right? And yeah, for centuries, this bothered nobody, right? And then in the 18th century, one of the features of modernity is that all of a sudden everyone's like, well, the two creation stories don't really fit together, right? I mean, so then you get sort of German scholars who are doing source criticism, and eventually, you know, Wellhausen comes up with the Yahwist versus the Eloist authors, and they look at the different chunks of the Pentateuch and said, oh, well, this is neither Yahwist nor Eloist. This is clearly the priestly hand or what have you, right? The construction of things, you know, the scholars who, and once you're thinking along these lines, it doesn't take much to look at the book of Isaiah and say, maybe not one guy, right? I mean, there's some head snapping tonal shifts in the book of Isaiah, right? And so whereas tradition just has, oh no, so this is Isaiah and sort of that's that, the German higher criticism in the 18th century comes along and says, okay, so this is coming from this, and this is coming from this, and taking apart the sources. And initially, like, it was sort of bad enough for these Protestant critics who were doing it when it was the Hebrew Bible that was being taken apart. But eventually, with David Friedrich Strauss's Life of Jesus, it gets applied to the Christian scriptures as well, which was still more unnerving. Like that's, did I go on too long?
No, this is great. This is great context. Yeah, it's right. And it is, you know, suddenly these are taken, you know, the question suddenly is, how then does the pure unmediated word of God fit into a picture now where it's also culturally mediated and dense with history, lots of different authors? You know, one of my favorites, the most obvious one, is near the end of, is it Deuteronomy, where it talks about Moses's death and burial?
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah, right. So this complicates things. And what you point out in your book is that, so these really much more sophisticated interpretive practices of the Bible and carry into the interpretation of literature. And I guess my question is, why did critics in the 19th century focus on Shakespeare, right? Why Shakespeare more than Milton or more than Spencer or others? What was so specifically rich or luring about Shakespeare?
Yeah, great question. A little bit complicated. And it's complicated in this way. Like there's nothing in Shakespeare. Part of the reason it's so intriguing that the Victorians went all in on the religious value of Shakespeare is that Shakespeare is not the most obvious case for such, like Milton is actually writing religious, but even Wordsworth, I mean, good Lord, like you can find tons of religious poets in the world. Shakespeare is just not one of them. You know, you've got like a couple sign of like poor soul, the center of my sinful earth. Like he knows a lot about the Christian faith. Like this is apparent from the work, but Shakespeare is not writing devotional poetry. But what the reason they focus upon him, the reason Shakespeare becomes their guy, is because of the romantic cult of poetry. Like it's connected to the higher criticism in this way. One of the things that the higher critics did when they said, you know, so the Bible is inspired. Yes, it is inspired, but it's just not inspired as like God's dictation or whatever. One term that the higher critics tended to lean upon is to say that, like, look, it's inspired in the way that poetry is inspired, right? This romantic ideal of poetry as a way of sort of getting beyond language into something divine and important is it's hard to overstate the importance of that for 19th century poetics. And it affects not just sort of the poets writing in the 19th century, which it certainly does affect. That's sort of the point of my first book, that they're sort of aware of this criticism and responding to it accordingly. It also affects the poetry that's already sort of in the tradition. Nothing would have surprised Shakespeare more, to my mind, than the interpretation that 19th century critics regularly gave him. I mean, I think it would have like blown Shakespeare away. The reason Shakespeare becomes, so he was already central to poetic culture. And then when all of a sudden poetic culture has a religious valence, then somehow like Shakespeare has to be religious. And then it's our job as scholars to sort of explain how.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah, that's very well said.
It's sort of a crazy accident, right? I mean, but fabulous in its way.
Yeah, it is. And I guess it's evidence of just how much, I guess, I myself am a creature of the 19th century, and that I love the idea of inspired writing being more distributed other than outside of the classical sacred texts like the Bible. I love the idea, right, of a Shakespeare that could be, you know, kind of inspired by some greater force. I even heard years ago on this documentary, Derrida, right? He was talking about when he gets writing, that some force, doesn't know where it comes from, kind of, you know, kind of just it informs how he's writing and what he does. And I doubt Derrida will want to claim, you know, kind of classical religious inspiration, but he was using the language of it, certainly, right? So it was Derrida's own 19th century Shakespeare moment, the way that you're talking
totally,
about.
Totally, yeah. No, and you know, Jürgen Habermas, looking at Derrida doing that, he's like, check out Derrida, like in the Philosophical Critique of Modernity, Habermas is like, Derrida is basically a high priest.
Right? Yeah, right.
I mean, where he like, he calls him on it, right?
That's right.
I mean, but then look at Habermas now, like we're all post-secular. So
It's okay. Yeah. All right. So you talk about some of the really, I mean, wonderfully elaborate and sometimes wacky forms, this what you call bardology, right? The study of the bard, getting away from the bardolatry, the worship of the bard. You kind of push back against that and talk about the deep study that's informed by these religious sensibilities. But these bardological forms took really kind of elaborate shape in the 19th century, that there are these Shakespearean sermons you talk about and Shakespearean devotional volumes. But I wonder if we could talk about one of these cases. Your book has a couple of images in it that I thought were just fantastic. And one, it's from page 57 of your book. It shows a page from an 1843 volume titled, and here's a long title, 19th century title, here it is, Religious and Moral Sentences Culled from the Works of Shakespeare Compared with Sacred Passages Drawn from Holy Writ. Okay, right. So now on that page, in one column of this book, you find passages from Shakespeare's plays, and the other column, there are biblical excerpts. So for example, the editor of that volume gives us a category titled Believe, okay, across the middle of the page. And on the Shakespeare half of the page, he has this quote from Hamlet, Before my God, I might not this believe without the sensible and true avouch of mine own eyes. And then that passage is juxtaposed with this verse from the Gospel of John. Then said Jesus unto him, Except ye see signs and wonders, ye will not believe. Now, you point out in your book these kinds of correspondences. Shakespeare said this, and it's kind of like that in the Bible. Don't really rise to the status of literary analysis, that there's no historical or dramatic context. There's no real feel for rhetorical nuance. There's no appreciation of dramatic or poetic form. And I'm wondering, can you explain then what the allure was of these correspondences to begin with, right? What are these correspondences in these volumes designed to reveal to their readers?
Yeah, fabulous. And your listeners can't sort of see the image, but it's clearly two facing pages where you sort of just go across from one to the other. Here's the Bible. And look, if you look across the page to the verso, you see that it's, well, I guess Shakespeare's on the verso and the Bible's on the recto, right? Where you just sort of look across. Here you go. Here's your correspondences. What are they even doing? So B.L.B. Watson is quite clear that the reason he's writing his book, the reason he like collected all these things, is to prove that Shakespeare knew his Bible well, and that Shakespeare was a good Protestant. Like he's quite open about this. Here's what I'm doing in 1843. I'm just gonna, like, there's some question about whether Shakespeare's a secret Catholic or whatever. Let me show you how this book works. And there can be no doubt that one of the things these books do speak to is the fact that Shakespeare did know the Bible well. Unquestionably true, right? Because Shakespeare was living in a culture that was saturated with the Bible.
Absolutely.
Right? Was the 19th century, as was B.L.B. Watson, right? This is not obscure. You know, the references are not obscure. There's a wonderful Shakespeare scholar named Alison Schell, who's, I think she's a historian. She's not someone I know. She's a British scholar, and she's got a book called Shakespeare and Religion, in which she says that in some ways, in the sort of 21st century, as Shakespeare scholars are trying to account for a more secular classroom, they've been more diligent about noting scriptural references than Shakespeare. And this practice by itself has made us way more alive to the density of religious allusion in Shakespeare than we were before. Like it's the fact that you can no longer take for granted that your student has read the Gospel of John that makes you sort of mark up all the references to the Gospel of John in the books, and then you become more alive to what Shakespeare is doing. B.L.B. Watson is not doing it as in a scholarly way, though, as you say. Like there's nothing in this reference to belief at the beginning of Hamlet. Like Horatio is seeing Hamlet Sr.'s ghost, right? He's talking about, boy, I wouldn't believe this if I didn't see it with my own eyes. And then somehow it's supposed to relate to the official in the Gospel of John, right? I mean, where you're just like, well, that's not, I mean, they just happen to use the same word, right? I mean, if your undergraduates came to you and said, Professor Wickman, you know, I think Horatio is referring to this passage in John. You'd be like, you know, like, you try to let them down gently, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so that's what's interesting is that the way BLB uses these references on both sides of his page are totally plucked from context, right? He's sort of finding an image, but he's totally indifferent to what, in some ways it's the opposite of the higher criticism, right? But also the opposite of sort of the way we do business in the English classroom, right? I mean, we who teach English at the university level, you teach students to consider context and what the passage means. And that's all stuff that the higher critics were doing as well.
Yeah, right, sure. Okay, so let me ask you this. In my own religious culture, one still finds members and church leaders occasionally citing Shakespeare over the pulpit. And it could be for a pithy phrase, right, that they
sure.
cite, or just as likely, it's an appeal to moral wisdom. And such appeals seem like they're a product of the 19th century, right? And one imputation of your book is that these kinds of appeals no longer really characterize literary study, at least not self-consciously by those, you know, who are critics in our modern era. I guess my question is, when did that kind of appeal to Shakespeare as this vault of moral wisdom, when did that fall out of favor in literary criticism? And I guess my other question is, do you think we've lost anything by uncoupling literature more generally from moral wisdom?
Yeah.
Can we be too larded in context so that we kind of lose sight of what these things might communicate outside their context?
Yeah. So this is something that I'm as interested in hearing your opinion on this as you are in hearing mine or still more. Because your sense of the evolution of the university English studies in the modern era is every bit as well informed as mine. What I can say is for certain, like in the 19th century, you're studying poetry, including secular, so-called secular poetry, for wisdom and for what it can teach you. There's no doubt that they go all in on this in a very sort of unashamed way. And then over the course of the 20th century, literary studies, partly, you know, for anxiety of its own, get further from that, right? One, the new critics want to have a scientific criticism so that we're not just sort of effusing over texts, right? And then the structuralists are like, wait, we can map it out. And then the deconstructionists, you know, deconstruct the mapping. Right. And then but what's characteristic of modern or 20th and 21st century now literary criticism is that each generation of literary scholars accuses the one before it of doing theology, right?
That's
like each
point.
Generation,
yeah.
Each generation is like, oh, those new critics, they were all just basically doing theology, right? And then the deconstructionists
right.
come along and they're like, oh, really? I mean, you got to get away from this, right? So the each generation looks at, you know, I learned your name, Matthew Wickman, from a beautiful article you wrote in PMLA. You weren't on my radar until I saw that PMLA article. And I just sort of written an argument about sort of what the weird way in which each generation of critics disavows the next. And I said, you know, sort of culminating most recently in Franco Moretti, the Marxist critic, who says that close reading is theological, right? Where he's like, if you're close reading a text, you're basically doing theology. And then Moretti, like everyone who came before him, is like, but what I'm going to do is going to be beyond theology. I'm going to take us beyond. And you write this PMLA article, which is entitled, if I'm remembering rightly, it's called Theology Still.
Yeah.
So, right, where you're like, where plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, right? I mean, it's a merry-go-round, right? Each generation of critic is like, well, you know, we were stuck in the sort of theological reverential mode before, but now we're going to get out of it. It was a beautiful article, and it was beautiful not least of all because you were much more generous with Moretti than I would have been, just in terms of the sort of, you're not just saying, look, Moretti, you know, Emperor's New Clothes, you're like, well, I mean, there's a way in which what you're doing is deeply secularized, blah, 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 right? I mean, so it was a great article, but I loved it because I'm like here, Matthew Wickman, this is a guy I got to meet because he's exactly right.
If I knew, Charles, that you were going to sort of talk about my work in this podcast, you'd be my guest every single week.
Fair enough. Yeah.
No,
what's your own sense about the, because there's no doubt that the 19th century, like when English arises as a discipline, you know, my own English department is 1892, toward a characteristic of a lot of state, you know, big flagship American universities. You know, sort of end of really the high point that in the reverential view of Shakespeare that I'm talking about in my book sort of arises to a crescendo in the fin de siècle. Like, and that's when all the English departments get established, right? And they're all reading Shakespeare, as I need not say, right? In my department, we have a bust of like Shakespeare, or the Seattle is not a, it's not a particularly reverential place, right? And we only have one bust in the English department, but it's from like way back in the day, and it's sort of Shakespeare's little mug, and the staff, like on football days, they put a, like, you know, purple and gold scarf on him and stuff, right? I mean, it's like so, but that reverential model, like, it's not that we haven't been doing it, because of course we do in bass awkward ways, but we haven't been trying to do it. Or we've been actively trying not to do it for some time. What's your own feeling about this?
I think your read on this, Charles, is really smart, and I agree with your assessment, and really like the way that you kind of summarize how this history works. My own sense is that clearly we don't want to do these kinds of reverential or moral or theological readings of literature because we literary scholars fancy ourselves more sophisticated. It's like the German higher criticism is the perpetual bar we keep, or the wheel we keep recreating, you know, where this time we finally got it as a historical document, when actually, you know, it's more complicated, it's more nuanced than that. I think, for example, of one of the great slogans in literary theory that was articulated by Frederick Jameson back in the early 1980s, right? In his book, The Political Unconscious, always historicize, right? Which is how that begins. And it's a very good point about the importance of contextualizing the work that we do. The funny thing is, though, that as a slogan, that's not historicized at all. It's, you know, always historicized right. As an absolute, you know, and that's quoted so often reverentially by those who don't always recognize that it's reverential reading that they're doing. This is back to my first question to you about, could you have, and in your case, would you have written a book like this without an understanding of religion? And you said, probably not. I think oftentimes, you know, you never find religion in our profession more frequently or more in some ways dramatically than among those who really don't have a, what they would call a religious life. So the ways that they remain theological or remain religious in their practice escapes them, it eludes them, which I find to be really enigmatic. I think at BYU, where I worked, it's founded 1875, so it's also a 19th century creation. But the moral side of all this remains an idea that the university embraces. And what that means for someone like me, you know, a professor, is like, well, how do I negotiate the terms of my profession, which are historically contextualizing on the one hand, with kind of the values of the university, which is there really is wisdom here that should be transmitted across generations, things that are inspired, right? That you should embrace as such and teach as such and engage your students as such. So there really is a push and pull that's not easy to negotiate. But I guess what I'd say in concert with you is that push and pull happens whether or not you want it to. It's just kind of baked into the literary culture, right, of which we're a part.
Yeah, totally. And I think too, like that when, you know, when 50 years ago, Roland Barthes says that the idea of authorship is secretly theological and should be dropped, It's not like we stopped talking about authors then. And indeed, people still reverentially refer to Barth himself, like in this the same kind of irony that you find in Jameson, right? Is without a doubt, like Barth himself becomes canonical, right? The right. texts that Absolutely. He write are reverenced because written by him, right? The levels of irony that get sort of built in. At the same time, I think that the mistake, or for me, my question or my response to your question of like theology still, are we still doing theology? Yes, we are. For me, what I'm trying to say is, yeah, we are. So that's fine, right? That's only a problem if you think that theology is a big problem, right? If it's only a problem if you're allergic to religion, right? If you're not, then like, sure. It's theological. It's also been rich and wonderful, right? I mean, Barth has given rise to a lot of really intelligent readings of literary texts. It's so I'm not trying to dog on Barth or whatever. I'm simply saying, like, yeah, okay, we can say that it is still theological. Sure, Franco Moretti, close reading is theological, but that's fine.
See, right? that's the important point. Yeah, it's that there is this kind of disavowal of the practice that we're actually doing. And I think in some respects, that disavowal is almost symptomatic of the ways, it almost explains why it is that literature fails to connect with a broader public. You know, I mean, in a way, the discussion becomes so abstract and so rooted in supposedly in history that it no longer communicates what is somehow imagined by the public as, you know, the universal human, a category that should absolutely be sort of analyzed and troubled and corrected and brought into a broader discussion about how we arrive at these ideas. But when we lose any sense of some kind of more general communicable sort of common features to our human story. Something about that is, I think, almost explains why it is that students end up saying, well, then if I'm not going to sort of learn about the big meaning, what it means to be human, why bother studying English at all?
Yeah, and I would say that what you're describing there, when you talk about sort of the disenchantment of the public with what we do, you're talking about academic study of English, because the public is still reading, like the public is still responding to literature and art. I don't think the public's given up on art in the least.
Absolutely. Right? That's a great point. Yes, indeed. I am talking academic, but your point is exactly right.
And I would, you know, I mean, I guess I would go so far as to say, well, all of us who are teaching in English department, even, you know, those among us who have devoted their lives to the hermeneutics of suspicion, or what, you know, Ricoeur calls the schools of suspicion, even those who think that they're conceive of their job as to sort of, you know, tear off the facade of any apparent goodness and show the, you know, hideous ideology lurking underneath. All of my colleagues who might imagine themselves as in that vein, they're still teaching works of literature for the wisdom that they offer, right? Yes. I mean, no one teaches Toni Morrison in my department and thinks that they're better than Toni Morrison, right? Or thinks that Toni Morrison doesn't have some wisdom to offer. Exactly. Like we're all on the same page there. Like everyone's like, yo, okay, she's, you know, brilliant, genius novelist. And is offering us and is teaching us some stuff, right? That there's no, like, so when I teach, you know, Elizabeth Barrett Browning or Emily Dickinson or Gwendolyn Brooks, I'm pretty open with my students of, you know, about the fact that their art, well, both A, that their art offers wisdom, and B, that it's that the art itself does things that, you know, it's not that Emily Dickinson was personally wise, about which I wouldn't speculate, but that her poetry is amazing and sort of does tremendous things. Like I feel very confident about that. Yeah, I was just at the Alice Walker came to give a talk in Seattle a couple of years ago, just pre-COVID, in the Seattle Arts and Lectures series. And I got a friend of mine who's does creative writing here, and I got her to come with me and go down to hear Alice Walker, someone who I've admired for decades. And we went to the talk, and like, it was sort of Benaroya Hall, downtown Seattle, is completely packed, right? Because the public has not given up on literature, nor on poetry. And the reading was fabulous. But, you know, speaking about sort of the spirituality of, you know, that, you know, much of the public is looking for and finding in literature. When we left Benaroya Hall on our way out, my creative writing colleague was like, she said, it was like a big AA meeting. Like, you know, that kind of like non-dogmatic, you know, religious-ish.
Yeah.
You know, sort of broadly theological, I guess.
Yeah,
I mean, it's theology still.
Yeah, that's right.
To use your language.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's exactly right. And I think that, yeah, you're right. The public has not given up on literature. I think, and literature professors haven't either. I mean, in defense of our profession, I think that people who are able to bring to bear these insights into Emily Dickinson, for example, or Gerard Manley Hopkins, someone else you've written about quite extensively, or others, and point out just kind of how these things work. You know, how these poems work, how they generate the effects they generate, you know, how they communicate the way that they do, what's in them that we might miss. There's tremendous value in this, which is very moving to people and mind opening. And you mentioned Alice Walker, you mentioned Toni Morrison, also can really expand our horizon for how we see others around us socially. I mean, these things are still alive. It's just that they're more alive, seems to me, sometimes among the public than they are inside of the journals of academic literary criticism.
Yeah, you know? And I definitely don't wish to be saying, I'm so one scholar whom I'm reading a lot and admiring right now is Rita Felsky, you know, precisely because she's so interested in, or Eve Sedgwick, you know, toward the end of Eve Sedgwick's career, where she's really deeply invested in recovering, doing more than the hermeneutics of suspicion. And something that both of these critics do that I would totally echo is, you know, honoring what ideology or critique has given us. Of course, like I'm not trying to like dismiss the value of that. Of course, it's an essential part of our work. But as Felsky says, it can't be like the only thing we do, like because there are other literature is doing other things. Literature is unruly, right?
That's right. Good.
It has all kinds of stuff in it that is hard to nail down, right? The field needs to be doing lots of different things. And that's, I guess, what Felsky, I think, is especially good at saying this. So again, Eve Sedgwick, when she comes up with reparative reading, and there's lots of people, you know, Emma Mason.
Yeah, pastoral reading.
Talking about pastoral reading. There's different kinds of ways of, like, in the 21st century, you know, scholars have, you know, even those of us who were especially good at ideology critique have expanded in what I would strike me as really healthy ways.
Yeah, I agree. And look, your book, both your books, Charles, do this, but the book we're talking about today, this Victorian Cult of Shakespeare that you published this year, is really good at this, you know, kind of showing how these religious sensibilities are, you know, swirling around with the more materialist, historicist sensibilities of the 19th century, and how this plays into the still the present day landscape of literary studies. One finds, you know, artifacts of these earlier practices still very much with us and alive. I think that's a really powerful thing about your work generally and about this book. Let me make one last sort of little transition here to talk about what you did at here at BYU a month ago. So I invited you to participate in a symposium we had here on the subject of belief. Now, as a backdrop to that, you know, you evoke the historian Charles Taylor. He's a famous historian of our secular era. And Taylor argues that religion doesn't disappear in the modern era. It just takes up residence in an expanded sort of variety of cultural forms, so that every position we hold, every idea that we have, whether it's secular or religious, Taylor says, is something we can now cast into question or scrutiny. Is that true? Is it false, et cetera? And what this means is that whether you are a hardcore believer, Taylor says, or whether you are a dogmatic, skeptical, you know, sort of thinker, you have to believe in what you're saying. No one can circumvent or get around the necessity of believing. And that means that religious sensibilities remain with us still. So the symposium at BYU was kind of about what belief means then in our modern age, right? What do we do with belief here in the present? And you gave this really great talk. And I'm wondering if you could give a little brief synopsis of what you were doing with the talk and what your contribution was to the symposium.
Yeah. So the talk I gave came out of the Shakespeare book in part because you said, hey, how do you feel about coming down and talking about belief? And I was, you know, one of the things that I address in the Shakespeare book is that all the people like Sir Frederick Bielby Watson who want to prove that Shakespeare was, you know, a staunch Protestant or a, you know, secret Catholic or whatever, like the Shakespeare, like we're not going to get there. Like the historical record is not going to say anything about Shakespeare's private beliefs. And I think that's great because I'm not especially interested in that in the first place. Like my interest is in sort of what the work does and is beyond him. But when I got your call for papers, I was thinking about, like, you know, how far would I take that? Like, what about poets whom I study and teach, who are clearly either belong or don't belong to faith tradition? So I gave a talk on Shakespeare, Christina Rossetti, and Gwendolyn Brooks. And I picked Christina Rossetti and Gwendolyn Brooks as sort of opposing examples. Christina Rossetti is a devout Anglo-Catholic and, you know, and wrote copiously about of devotional literature and such. And Gwendolyn Brooks, again, on the historical record, it's quite clear that she leaves behind Methodist Episcopal Church, the AME Church of her upbringing, but then continues to write religiously inflected verse. And so the two examples that I give are the sort of Anglo-Catholic poet who's writing verse that it's not that hard to read as heretical, and the ostensibly post-Christian poet who's writing all kinds of verse that it's not that hard to read as religious. Indeed, that you almost can't not, right? I mean, I was looking at picking a poem, I picked the Second Sermon on the Warp Land, which is just fabulous. And it's clearly an example of Christian prophetic writing in the Black tradition, right?
That probably moving, by the way. That poem moved me so much when you read that.
Yeah, no, because it's an amazing poem. And I was honestly like, so because last June, when our seniors were graduating, we were all the faculty, like we couldn't have an in-person ceremony because of COVID. So they asked us, you know, will you please, you know, make a short Zoom video? And I wanted to give my students, like, it was such a hard time for them. It was such a hard time. And I wanted to give them, you know, I wanted to give them something moving and life-giving. And so Brooks it was because of graduation that I used Brooks in my presentation for you, because I was trying to think of like a moving, life-giving poem that I could, you know, give them, recite a chunk of for them. And the Second Sermon on the Warp Land, I think, is just a gorgeous piece of art.
Yeah, it was a great choice.
Yeah, so it was good. It was. So my wife, when I sort of had recorded this, she's also on faculty here, and she's like, I didn't realize that that was what we were supposed to be doing. She had separately made a recording in which she'd put on a squid hat and made a lot of puns. so different way of going into the graduation ceremony. You know, we showed, they were so different that we showed my sisters, like we sent them both the links. And one of my little sisters, she goes, I don't know if it was a competition, but Colette won.
That's right. If you put on a squid hat, you are the hype police in the English department.
Reality. Yeah. Yeah. So
Charles, you're doing such terrific work in literary studies, and it's not only is it really insightful, it's also very beautifully written. It's fun and interesting and really engaging, and I'm so grateful that the work is there, and I'm very grateful you came on today to talk about this with me, and I look forward to having further conversations both on the podcast and outside. So
yeah, thank you. It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.